Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How close is slavery to the life that you live? While fair trade programs have helped raise awareness of slave-made goods from faraway places, experts believe there are people forced to work without pay or the freedom to leave in communities all over the United States as well, sometimes as sex workers, sometimes as domestics in the homes of captors who might seem like perfectly normal people to anyone outside. So how do these people find themselves in slavery, and why do they find it so difficult to escape? Finally, what does it take to live in a slave-free community? Kevin Bales is president of Free the Slaves in Washington, D.C. His new book is called The Slave Next Door, Human Trafficking and Slavery in America Today. Kevin, welcome to Think.
Chris, great to be here.
Where are slaves working in the U.S. today?
Well, you know, there have been federal anti-slavery cases in every single state of the union now. So the answer is everywhere in the United States. But I'll tell you that the concentrations are around the edges. So within ethnic communities on the eastern and western seaboards, and as well as in the agricultural work across the South.
And these are largely people who are immigrants to the United States.
Well, there's a couple of categories. I mean, one is that, yes, we know a lot more about those people who are human trafficking victims from other countries into the United States to be enslaved in the United States. But it's also true that, as it were, indigenous Americans, regular American citizens, are sometimes enslaved as well.
And it's not just adults. In fact, a case that hits very close to home is profiled in the book. There are children in slavery in this country.
Oh, yes. Yes. I mean, if people are available to be enslaved and are useful in whatever kind of economic activity the criminals are interested in pursuing, then they'll take children into that situation, too.
And the case that I'm talking about is there was a boys' choir that was formed in Africa and brought to tour in the United States.
Exactly. The case particularly of Gibbon Kachepa, but the boys' choir that he was with, a wonderfully sounding boys' choir, they sing so beautifully, formed in a church in Zambia and then brought by a minister from Texas to the United States to tour churches, mostly in Texas and New Mexico, and raise money. You know, love offerings were asked for at the end of their concerts, and ostensibly to pay to build churches and to help the families of the children who were in the choir. They came from an extremely destitute small town in Zambia, and their families were desperate, and through that desperation also willing to let them go. But the man who put it together was pocketing the money. And it was all a charity scam. And the boys themselves were kept under very close physical coercive control and had been enslaved as a boys' choir. It's very strange, but as a boys' choir.
And not only did he provide them none of the education that their families were promised these boys would receive, but when host families who would keep them for a few days while they were performing would give them gifts, you know, new sneakers and clothes and things like that, he would confiscate all that.
Exactly, and forbid them to talk, and forbid them to write to host families, and would withhold food from them if he felt they were being resistant in any way. So they would leave them hungry. Sometimes lock them into the trailer where they all slept, a whole bunch of them in a small trailer. And when they weren't singing, often put them to work doing things like digging a hole for a swimming pool.
Let's talk for a minute about the psychology of this, because I think a lot of people who have not been in this sort of situation imagine that the moment that anyone in any kind of slavery situation was in a relatively safe environment, say with a host family that didn't believe in slavery and had no idea what was going on, that the first thing that you do would be to tell these people and to try to get yourself to safety. What kinds of threats are made against individuals in slavery that make it almost impossible for them to do this?
Well, a whole number of them, but Chris, I'd say you're absolutely right. It's very easy for Americans who live in freedom to say, well, you know, if you come to a free country, it must be possible for you to walk away. But the reality is that if you've been told that if you'd say anything, do anything, or try to run away, your family in your back home will be hurt or you're killed. You know, your family members, your mother might be killed. That's very common. The fact that you've also been brutalized, you're often in shock. Because you've been beaten up, you've been starved, you've been sleep-deprived, you've been left addled, and so you're confused, you're feeling that fear as well. That also makes it very hard to walk away. And then, of course, It's very often the case that you don't speak the language, the needed English, often to fit in. You don't know where you are. You have a fear of police because you might come from a country where the police are corrupt and are not necessarily known for law enforcement. They're known for violence and exploitation. And you roll those together with that constant surveillance, or to that point, as with the boys' choir, kids who were so cowed, so frightened, so controlled, so coerced, so brainwashed in a way, that he didn't have to worry about leaving them with a host family because he knew that they would do exactly what he hoped.
And in some cases, they are brainwashed to fear the very people who might help them, even outside of law enforcement, that they should never trust these strangers who seem kind.
Precisely. There's sometimes it's called the Patty Hearst syndrome or the Stockholm syndrome, that there begins to be an identification with the person who's holding you. And the person who's holding you in slavery is saying, you know, of course this is tough. Of course I'm having to discipline you. And of course, you know, you don't like this, but I can assure you it'd be much, much worse. I'm the only person you can count on to keep you alive. It'd be much worse no matter who you talk to.
Kevin, for obvious reasons, these things are notoriously difficult to count. But can you talk about the estimates as to how many people might be living in slavery today in the United States?
Sure. And again, emphasizing that these are estimates, our organization did work for the United Nations just a few years ago. We were asked to estimate those numbers for the global report that the United Nations was making. We were able to locate and point to 10,000 people that were caught up in cases that we could identify them as actual individuals. So people we could point to in the United States who had been in slavery, 10,000. But, of course, that's just the tip of the iceberg, and we know that. Very conservatively, I would say 40,000 to 50,000 people in slavery in the United States today.
Do you think that a country like ours, with a shameful history of having legally kept people enslaved for centuries, followed by a proud history of overturning that, makes it harder for us to recognize what slavery is when we see it?
You know, I don't, actually. I don't think that's what keeps us from seeing slavery when it's right in front of us, because it's happening in all other developed countries as well, that people are having a hard time seeing it. And in some ways, I actually believe, through my experience, that many Americans are more attuned to slavery because of our history of enslavement. There's a kind of resonance that Americans have. But it's certainly the case that as long as we pat ourselves on the back and say, wasn't it great that we used to have slavery but we don't anymore, it makes it harder and harder for us to see slavery when it's really there. When the fact is, there's never been a day in the United States or in America or in the American colonies, there's never been a day without slavery since the very beginning of our country.
So given the fact that slavery is illegal everywhere on Earth, and given the fact that there are millions of slaves working as we speak, Kevin, is that an indication that the laws that we have are completely ineffective?
The laws are effective if they're enforced. So it's not about the laws. It's really about the enforcement. We have a really good law in the United States on human trafficking that was passed in the year 2000, one of the best in the world. But the level of enforcement is such that any objective viewpoint would be, we don't really care about this issue at all. There's a very easy way to illustrate that, and that's to point out that the State Department estimates that about 17,000 people are trafficked into the U.S. every year from other countries, 17,000 new slaves, according to the government, each year. It's an interesting coincidence that about 17,000 people are murdered in the United States each year. Mm-hmm. So we have 17,000 new slaves and 17,000 homicide victims. But we also have about 60 to 70,000 homicide specialists in our police departments, you know, the sort that you see on evening television, you know, the murder squads and all that. But some 60,000 people who are highly trained to deal with 17,000 murders, how many anti-trafficking, anti-slavery specialists do we have in the country's police departments? Well, the best guess is something between 50 and 100. Now, you can't take a crime of that size with that many victims and devote a handful of people to it if it's a serious crime. You know, with murder, we get the right kind of notions. We need to have squads in every, particularly in those locations where there's where there's likely to be human trafficking and slavery. And then we'll begin to see the good laws effectively enforced.
Well, and it's so disturbing to read in this book that even on the rare occasions that people are, in fact, sort of caught red-handed with slaves, prosecuting them and getting them to really tough sentences is incredibly difficult.
It has been. I have to say it's getting a little better in that just since the book's come out, I've seen more information from the Justice Department that they've been bumping up the levels of sentences, and they've even pulled some people back that were previously sentenced and resentenced them at a higher level. But it's also true that because law enforcement have not received the training that they need to do their jobs well, that they're not necessarily collecting evidence and building cases in a way that they will when they get the training and they get the experience in this. And when you don't build the cases well, it's hard for the prosecutors to get the convictions and the high sentences.
So the Bush administration made a huge amount of effort into slavery and anti-slavery, but it was focused a lot on the sex slave trade. Can you talk about why, although you certainly don't disagree with their intention, that focus specifically isn't necessarily a good thing?
Well, I have to say, I think you said something like they made a big effort. They didn't. They made a small effort. Mm-hmm. They talked a lot of big words, but they didn't necessarily deliver on the ground in terms of the resources necessary. But they also focused especially on trafficking and exploitation into prostitution, which is very important. It's the largest proportion of people enslaved in the United States, not half, but just under half of all the people that we think are enslaved in the U.S. are enslaved into prostitution. But if you focus on that one particular form of enslavement, it does distract people from the many other kinds of enslavement. Agricultural workers and domestic workers are the classic examples. And it also takes it into a perception that we're not fighting slavery, we're fighting prostitution. And that becomes a kind of diversion of worries about slavery itself. So that very often you'd hear the government officials talk about there is sex trafficking and, by the way, some other forms of trafficking that we'll get to in time. I'm happy to say that began to shift, and it's shifting even more quickly now under the new administration. And there's a really clear emphasis across the board on slavery, not just a particular outcome of slavery.
Well, let's go to the title of your book for a minute, The Slave Next Door. This focuses specifically on domestic slavery. How would people find themselves in a situation where they are working for free as a nanny or a maid or a gardener?
It's a classic bait and switch. And it's very often they do things that you or I would do if we were in their shoes. It's very often educated young people who want a chance to come to the Americas or to America and get a chance at an education or a decent job so they can support their family back home in whatever country it might be. But what happens is they listen to recruiters, they listen to families who intend to employ them, and I'm saying that with quotation marks, and discover when they get here that it's all been a lie, that there's been no intention to allow them to earn money or to get an education or whatever. So it's all about trickery.
Kevin Bales is my guest. He's president of Free the Slaves. We're talking about his new book, The Slave Next Door, Human Trafficking and Slavery in America Today. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is president of the nonprofit organization Free the Slaves, Kevin Bales. His new book is called The Slave Next Door, Human Trafficking and Slavery in America Today. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. You have an amazing story in the book, Kevin, of a woman who lived literally next door to a family that had sort of someone that I suppose the owners called a houseboy, someone who was expected to sort of do all of the domestic labor within that house. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yes. A young man from India who had been brought in by a couple who were also originally from India, but of a much higher caste, and was put in that typical situation of a domestic person enslaved in the United States, the kind of sleeping in the utility room, eating the scraps, and under pretty arbitrary and often violent control of particularly the woman who ran the house.
And the neighbor sort of got to know this young man and became, to the extent that it was possible, friendly with him, and they would trade recipes and things like that. And she started to think that perhaps something was amiss.
And this is not unusual, this idea of people realizing, wow, there's something not right about this situation. She was beginning to realize that he was seemed a bit terrorized, had no freedom of movement, almost never left the house except to occasionally do some shopping, and also was able to watch as her neighbor would berate and treat this person in a way that just didn't seem possible in a nice suburban neighborhood.
And I suppose when you observe something like this, you still go through a period of denial where you think, surely I'm not seeing what I think I'm seeing.
I think that's exactly right. And what's more, you know, it's fascinating to know that about a third of the people who come out of slavery in the United States each year come out because of a good Samaritan, because of a neighbor, because of someone who sees something that doesn't look right. So they're crucially important. The people that help people. But what we don't know is how many of the people who see someone in a situation that they think is wrong or strange or just not right, but then never say a word because they don't feel like it's their place or they don't know who they should talk to or what to do about it.
So this all came to a head when this couple decided that they needed another slave and brought a woman over to arrange a marriage for this young man that they were keeping enslaved.
Yes, it's a bit horrific. It's almost like breeding livestock. This idea that you would say, well, I think this we would calm down our houseboy cook a little bit if we brought him a woman to be with, and we'll arrange this marriage, which they did, brought the young woman over from India. You can only imagine how strange and frightening that experience could have been for her to find herself in a nice home, but in a situation of complete and total control. But there's something here about misery loving company, because the young couple really did grow to very fond of each other and really fell in love with each other over time,
which infuriated the woman who was in charge of them.
Well, because she was pulling their strings like puppets. She did not plan for them to fall in love and really love. She wanted a pair of robotic, willing workers. But there's something about that falling in love that makes two people into a team, and they begin to think and plot and try to figure out a way out.
So the neighbor, the Good Samaritan neighbor, finally attended a dinner party or something, right, and sort of took this young man aside?
Exactly. Took him aside and said, I have come to understand what's going on here as best I can, and I am going to arrange a situation where if you and your wife can get out of here to a certain place, I'm going to make sure that you've got some transport and to go to a particular place where someone will employ you. The young man was as the neighbors says, a fantastic cook. And she knew that it would be possible for him to support himself and his wife, given a chance. So she opened that door. I mean, she was kind of a soccer mom Harriet Tubman in the sense of, providing that little conduit out and into a place of freedom.
And the neighbors didn't discover that she had anything to do with this?
As far as she knows, they never found out.
What sort of possibilities are there for people who are freed from slavery to get a legal visa to remain in the United States?
Well, that's part of our the good law that I mentioned earlier that we passed in the year 2000, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. Before we had that law, people who were in slavery would sometimes be uncovered by the police and then immediately simply assumed to be undocumented aliens and deported, often deported back into the hands of the very people that enslaved them. Today, under that law, if you are found in a situation of slavery, if you're a victim of human trafficking, it means that you can apply for a particular visa. It's called a T visa. That visa allows you to stay in the country, particularly while, especially while there's attempts to prosecute the slaveholder. But it allows you to have access to economic support, health care, housing, and so forth. And ultimately, after a few years, assuming you've met other qualifications, to apply for a green card.
On the other hand, Kevin, am I correct about this, that if slaveholders are detected and prosecuted and their assets are seized, that money does not go directly to the people that they have kept in bondage?
That's correct, under the federal law. But there are, I have to say, there are some moves afoot right now to shift that and make sure that, in fact, the proceeds of the stolen labor go back to the person whose labor was stolen, which is exactly the obvious and fair thing that should happen. It's also possible that state laws, we have a number of state laws now coming into force, that they can provide for that kind of asset seizure and forfeiture, but not back simply to, say, law enforcement or state government, but back to the victims of that crime. It was only a couple of years ago that we were able to bring forward what's called a civil right of action for human trafficking victims, which means they can then sue people who have enslaved them in a civil case to allow them to reclaim in another way what's been stolen from them.
We should say that the being freed is only the first in a very long step toward recovery. And you mentioned that there are some assets and some assistance programs available, but can you talk about what someone who has been formerly enslaved has to cope with in returning to freedom into the real world?
Well, you know, it varies a lot from person to person who's come out of slavery, but you can easily imagine that almost every person who's come out of human trafficking is traumatized. And it's important to remember that the trauma that they suffer is not like the trauma that most of us may have experienced. For example, you're in an automobile accident and it's over in 10 seconds, or even, God forbid, you know, you've been mugged, which is over in 20 seconds. This is a kind of trauma that goes on and on, regular brutality, regular rape or sexual assault, regular starvation, a regular mental torture that goes on as well. And it can last months or years or even decades. So we're talking about very significant need for psychological help. What's really amazing is how resilient and how people who have come out of slavery very often bounce back very quickly. But you must address that and usual medical health issues as well. The young boys that we mentioned a moment ago that were in the boys' choir enslaved in Texas, after they were set free, they were found, some of them have live tuberculosis in their systems, internal parasites, all sorts of things that had brought, some of them had brought with them from Africa, but had never been dealt with, and they'd never had the most rudimentary health checkup in the United States. Healthcare, housing, job training, chance at education, everything that a person should have simply to get onto their feet and make a new start in life.
One horrible irony that you make very clear here is that because slavery is, in fact, illegal everywhere, that makes the cost of a slave very low. And in fact, these human beings are considered more disposable today when kept in slavery than they might have been under a sort of legal system of slavery.
Well, legal or illegal, it's not so much about the legality of it, but the reason the price of human beings has collapsed globally is mostly to do with the population explosion and the very large pool of potentially enslavable people now in the world. There's about a billion people who live on less than a dollar a day, another billion who are just a little above that, all of whom are desperate for education and for employment and a chance often to escape the dangerous, chaotic places where they live, where they're plagued by civil war, ethnic cleansing, what have you. That pool of potentially enslavable people is now so large that it's simple supply and demand. There's a glut of potential slaves on the market, and the price has completely fallen. So the price of a slave in the past, Alabama, 1850 is a great example. The average slave then, and I mean a field worker, an agricultural worker, would have been about $40,000 in today's money, $40,000 to $50,000 in today's money. Today, almost anywhere in the world, the average price of a slave is around $100. And even in an expensive country like the United States, the price of a human being in that criminal market rarely goes above four figures.
And a lot of people are confused by this, but yours is not the only organization that says boycotts of products that might, in fact, contain slave labor are not necessarily the answer to the problem.
Well, and the answer to that is actually very logical, and once it's explained, it becomes pretty clear. It has to do with the fact that unlike, say, cotton before the Civil War, where the vast majority of it had slave input, most of the commodities in the world today that have slavery only have a tiny bit of slavery. So what I mean is, you know, if we're looking at cocoa in West Africa, where there is slavery in cocoa growing, but it's only 2 or 3% of the farms that grow cocoa that have slavery. And the same is true for cotton or coffee or sugar or lots of other products that we use. The problem is that if we suddenly boycotted West African cocoa, we would very seriously punish the farmers that weren't using slaves in an attempt to get at the ones that were using slaves. So 98% of all the farmers, honest farmers, we would be clobbering over the head with the hammer of a boycott in an attempt to hurt the 2% that do. So the real strategy, the right way to go about it, is not a boycott, but to actually try to find those farms with slaves and stop it where it's happening.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org, which is where we hear from Rollins, who says, another form of slavery is this. Employers seek foreign college students and hire them, again in quotes, promising to file with ICE to secure and extend their immigration status, which lapses 1 year after graduation. Employers debit money from their pay, pretending to pay lawyers who either don't exist or are part of the scam. Then when the visa expires, and with it any legal recourse, they have an employee who is here illegally and has zero protection and becomes their tacit slave. Have you heard of cases like that as well?
I have indeed, and I have to say, we may or may not be talking about slavery in that situation. The reason I say may or may not is that if in that process they end up with a person who literally cannot walk away, if they're under control not just of the bureaucratic manipulation but of actual violence as well, then we would say this person is in slavery. Otherwise, we have to say, well, this person has been extremely heinously exploited by very sharp business practice. But it's also true that the H-1 visas and other visas that we use for the importation of students and workers just like that often provide a backdoor into our country for enslavement.
And in other parts of the world, though, debt bondage is a huge way that people find themselves in slavery and completely unable to ever work their way out of whatever it is they're supposed to have owed.
Oh, yes. But, you know, to be clear, we call it debt bondage because there's a debt involved in the original rationalization of how someone is enslaved. But in every country, the repayment of that debt is actually illegal. If you use a debt which is not properly accounted for or has any kind of fair interest rate applied to it, or it's manipulated in other ways, there's some other very complicated ways that it can happen, then that debt doesn't actually stand as a legal debt. It's not like the mortgage that you took out to buy your home. And there is, however, a cultural expectation for a lot of workers that if they believe that they have, in fact, received something and that they do have a fair debt, that, in a sense, moral control is exercised as another way to hold people in slavery.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Sue Chang in Dallas. Hi, Sue Chang.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
My question is, out of the 40,000 to 50,000 estimated to be enslaved in the United States, what percentage of those slaves do you believe are so-called sexual slaves?
My best estimate in terms of what proportion of the people in slavery in the United States are enslaved into sexual exploitation would be just under half, something like 47% or 48%.
And when these people are freed, if and when that happens, how often do they end up back in prostitution because they have no other prospects?
Well, if they are freed into the system the way it's supposed to work, the chance that they're going to end up back in prostitution is very, very low. And let's remember that a very large number of the people who are women, I should say, or who are enslaved into prostitution in the United States had no intention to be in prostitution. They thought they were coming here to work as a waitress or in a shop or whatever. They experience serial rape and have completely against their choice. They're not likely under any circumstances to flow back into prostitution.
Are medical workers who occasionally have to treat these people, I know that they're often not given any medical care, are they a good line of defense in terms of spotting these people?
They certainly are, and there's some projects underway, but certainly not extensive, and this is another place in which our government needs to spend a little time and thought about how to help medical workers have the training they need to spot enslaved people. Medical workers have been really important in a number of cases who have said, again, there's something not right about this situation. There's something wrong about the fact that this man always wants to be present when I'm examining this young woman. This man always wants to interpret for her. This man seems, and she seems to be afraid of him. They get it that something's not right. Now we just need to help them to do it because it's the one of the few places where trafficked people, enslaved people, may end up.
My guest is Kevin Bales. He is president of the organization Free the Slaves. After this break, we will talk about the ideas the organization has for making your city a slave-free city. Some of the ideas are remarkably simple and things that we can all be doing. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is president of Free the Slaves, based in Washington, D.C., Kevin Bales. His new book is called The Slave Next Door, Human Trafficking and Slavery in America Today. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. So you present us with some ideas, Kevin, for creating a slave-free city. And there's a plan that has five parts. First, talk about how you sort of get everyone on board with putting this plan in place.
Well, obviously the first thing you have to do to make something like a slave-free city is for the people of the city and of the community to decide they want to live in a slave-free city. And, of course, there's probably a step before that one, which is recognizing that they might, in fact, be living in a city that does have slavery. And, of course, Dallas-Fort Worth area, we know there's been slavery there. Honduras, people from Korea, people from Zambia have all been enslaved in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And groups like Mosaic Family Services and the federal prosecutors there have had very significant federal grants to fight human trafficking just in the Dallas area. So I think with the recognition of that, I'm pointing at your town, not any town, but to say if people in Dallas said, We would like to live in a slave-free place, and maybe for the first time in American history we'd like to live in a slave-free place. And once you've decided that, then it's about saying it out loud in the press and letters to the editor, maybe on KERA, talking to the Chamber of Commerce, talking in your churches, in your schools, and saying, how about we get together and make this a reality?
And I can't imagine that the people who have this idea and want to make this a reality encounter much official resistance, but there's more to it than simply putting a proclamation out there.
Well, of course, because proclamations usually don't free anybody. I mean, you have to do the work. The question, you know, the rub will come when the people who want to live in a slave-free Dallas, Fort Worth, go to the city council and the police chief and the mayor and everyone and say, this is really what we want to accomplish. Now, let's begin to work through how we accomplish that and how we're going to make sure there are some resources brought to bear on that. It doesn't have to be desperately expensive, and certainly the first step is one that's about simple public education, making sure that every person who lives inside the city limits has an idea, has that basic education about how to recognize a person who might be a trafficking victim, might be a victim of slavery in their neighborhood or in a shop that they go to or whatever, in exactly the same way that we, you know, we all learn to understand how to avoid blowing our homes up with gas cookers or whatever, you know, basic, fundamental safety, law enforcement, public awareness information.
So give us some sense of what we might look for in our own neighborhoods or in our communities sort of beyond the neighborhood. What would be a tip-off that someone might be enslaved?
Well, tip-offs include someone who looks a little beaten down, because people in slavery often are beaten down, scarred or bruised and that sort of thing, but also fearful, especially fearful if it seems like someone's always right there to control them. If you can get a little closer, if you can determine whether or not they have their travel documents, one of the first steps that human traffickers do is take the passports and the travel documents away from people. If you can chat with someone and say, do you ever get out? Can you operate independently? Have you ever been paid for your work? But the tip-off usually is right at the beginning. It's when you see someone who really does look so beaten down that it's a good indication that something wrong is going on.
Is there a good way to approach someone like that so that you don't sort of scare them into fearing you as much as they fear their captors?
Well, gently and carefully, but, you know, it also might be that you don't want to approach them right off. It might be that if you see people in situations where there are people around who look a little dangerous, who look a little thuggish, who could well be the criminals who control them, rather than approach them yourself, you might want to speak to the police, or there's a national hotline that would then refer back to local law enforcement and back to local service providers. And the number for that hotline is very simple. It's 888-3737-888.
What are the most kinds of effective law enforcement training? Because you also, if you were to call the authorities, you have to be confident that whoever goes to investigate this knows what to look for as well.
Well, and I have to say, in Dallas-Fort Worth, you have some trained people now. You have some really good members of the local anti-trafficking task force. So I would feel confident calling into Dallas-Fort Worth. But, you know, they're the ones who have spoken to the real experts, who have done a lot of work around this, who look at exactly the sorts of things that I mentioned a moment ago about fearfulness and injury and so forth. But because they're law enforcement, they have the ability to stop and ask further questions about status and care and the nature of work and so forth. And those all will begin to open up the issues. And, of course, they'll also be asking questions that are reflecting exactly the violation that they might be observing.
So what do we do if there are people within our community that have been freed? How do we support them?
Well, it's an interesting one. The government itself, the federal government, provides some funds for people who have come out of slavery to support them. But it's a fairly low amount given the fact that they may be needing a fair bit of support, psychological, medical, legal, and so forth. So in some ways, the best way is to support those groups who are providing those services to those victims. I know one well in Dallas-Fort Worth area is Mosaic Family Services, mm-hmm. and they do a great job and have for a long time. A lot of people look to them for guidance who are coming into this area. But there's also a strange point here, which is that, you know, if someone came around collecting in your neighborhood and they were collecting for the United Way, you'd say, well, of course, I could, I'd support the United Way. But if I came to your door and I said I'm collecting, you know, to fight murder, homicide, you'd think, why would I give you that money? Why doesn't the government take care of that? And yet, sadly and strangely, groups like mine and groups like the ones in Dallas that provide those services have to go around and ask for charity to support victims of a crime that are actually the responsibility of our state, city, and federal governments. And we have to be asking not just how do we support them from our own pocket, but how do we get our elected representatives to do their job and support the people that we've already chosen as appropriate recipients.
You've also found evidence that United States tax dollars indirectly have supported slave labor. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, this was a very ugly kind of case, that in the period after the military operations in Iraq, in which the building of the new U.S. embassy, the building of the new U.S. compounds in Baghdad in the what's called the Green Zone, a large part of that work was subcontracted. Those subcontractors then subcontracted again and again to labor recruiters and so forth until exactly the kind of criminal trafficking recruitment I described earlier about offering people a lot and then doing the old bait and switch occurred with workers from Nepal and other countries who were brought into Baghdad, brought into very dangerous situations after being told they were hired to work in completely different countries, and then put to work on U.S. tax dollar-funded construction jobs.
Yeah, they thought they were going to Dubai.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then, sadly, a number of them were killed by Iraqi insurgents, placed into situations where it was, in fact, illegal for them to be under the laws of their own country, who said that they couldn't be taken to Iraq. It was a pretty ugly situation.
And something similar happened after Hurricane Katrina.
Indeed, there were, again, subcontractors of subcontractors who reached out to workers from a number of different countries to do the rebuilding of and wreckage clearance from Hurricane Katrina around New Orleans and the south coast of Mississippi, locked people into trailers, put them in old army camps, you name it, but the situation was precisely that of a trafficking victim. In situations where the paid never materialized, the work was onerous, and the control was total.
Kevin Bales is my guest. We'll go back to the phones now and speak with Maria in Arlington. Hi, Maria.
Hi. I'm studying to be a teacher, and I'm not even talking yet, but one of my goals is to not only be an advocate for the children, but for their families. And I was wondering, if slaves have children, could I possibly encounter them in my classroom? And if I did, what sorts of symptoms would they display? How would I be able to tell?
Interesting question. Thanks for your call.
It's an interesting question, Maria. I have to say it's in many ways unlikely that a child who's been trafficked would ever end up in a classroom. That's the most likely thing, that you wouldn't ever confront them. Because the point of them being enslaved is that no one's interested in letting them get an education. The point is to exploit them. If a child who had been trafficked somehow eased out of that situation and ended up in your classroom, it would be very much the kind of presenting behaviors that you would see in a child who'd been abused, because the physical and very often sexual abuse of a child in slavery would mirror that of any other kind of physical and sexual abuse in terms of how it would look. But let me also say, Maria, that our organization provides teaching packs to teachers. On our website, which is freetheslaves.net, you can download a teaching pack which is appropriate for upper grade school and middle school students, along with videotapes that you can use in teaching. So if you want to help the students understand the situation, there's also materials.
Let's go next to John in Dallas. Hello, John.
Yes. 3 or 4 years ago, I read in the New York Times of cases where people who worked for the UN from African countries, not from ourselves, were busted for having slaves. These were extensive columns that were written. I wonder, did you cover that in your first 20 minutes? I missed it.
We haven't talked about that. Are you familiar with the case, Kevin?
Oh, yes, indeed. And yeah,
I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for your call.
You didn't miss it because we didn't talk about it, but it's certainly covered in the book. One of the situations, it's not just about the United Nations, it's also about the whole concept of diplomatic immunity. the fact that diplomats in the United States have a loophole in our laws and in international law, which allows them to bring their own servants, which can include drivers and gardeners as well as maids and butlers and all that sort of thing. They can bring them in. They can bring them in without really hardly any checks being made and certainly no monitoring. And it means that it could be a UN diplomat or it could be a foreign national diplomat, and they will bring people in slavery and enslave them. Certainly where I'm sitting right now in Washington, D.C., there have been a number of those cases. There is a very we raise this as a very serious point in the book, and we say, why is it that someone from overseas has to bring their own gardener? Why aren't American gardeners good enough to get them through an employment agency like everybody else? And argue that it's really time to close a number of these loopholes that give special privileges which lead to enslavement to foreign diplomats.
Will you talk for a minute about U.S. lawmakers that you think have really taken an appropriate role in trying to make sure that this is a country where slavery is not permitted?
Well, there are a number of lawmakers at the federal level who have been leading on this. Sam Brownback, the senator from Kansas. Paul Wellstone, rest in peace, the senator from Minnesota, Senator Tom Harkin from Iowa. Those senators, for example, have all been great on this, as have Frank Wolf from Virginia in Congress and Elliot Engel from New York. I'm talking on both sides of the aisle, the far right and far left and middle. But I have to say the interesting thing is that all of those wonderful legislators who have worked hard against slavery and trafficking have almost all told me, you know, I only do this because I feel deeply about it. None of my constituents ever mentioned this to me. This is not an issue back in my district. And I think we'd have a lot more legislators doing the right thing if more of us as citizens let them know that this is a worry for us.
So make a call, write an email, get a petition together.
Sure. Or just let them know. You know, we know you've voted the right way on these bills because almost no one votes for slavery. When we bring something to Congress, we'll always get good support. But we don't have that kind of enthusiastic support that would help us to make much more quick progress.
Are there places in the United States that have become slave-free cities to your satisfaction?
No, there are not. So, you know, if the listeners of KERA think they would like to lead the world and do something monumental and historic, this is their opportunity.
And again, there are a lot of resources. Certainly people can pick up a copy of the book, and there are a lot of resources online. Give us your website again.
It's freetheslaves, all one word, .net.
Terrific. Kevin Bales is president of Free the Slaves. They are based in Washington, D.C. His new book is called The Slave Next Door, Human Trafficking and Slavery in America Today. Kevin, very informative hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Chris, it's been great. Thank you so much for letting me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.